Welcome to the Aftershock Central podcast with Ronnie and Martin. We're just switching off every week.
Yeah, it seems like it. We can't go full Voltron.
No, everyone's busy. Travis is on assignment. He has entered the warehouse. Mm-hmm. Be afraid. Be very afraid. I don't know what he's doing. He's traveling or something, he said? I don't know.
Yeah.
That's good. Good for him.
Yep. Next week he'll be traveling too, so.
Oh, yeah. And then next week we'll all be traveling, or the week after.
Yeah, right.
So I guess we should tell everyone, we'll most likely have an episode next week, but the week after, most likely we will not have an episode because we will all be at C2E2 in Chicago.
Yep, and we may or may not be fully functional.
Yes, we cannot guarantee we will have the mental capacity to record in 2 weeks, so yep. We'll just warn everyone ahead of time. But, you know, we're recording today. That's all that matters, Ronnie.
That's all that matters.
That's all that matters. We have two books to talk about today. Do we have any news?
Nope. Not that I'm aware of.
Good. No news is good news. Let's talk about these books.
Let's go.
We have Oberon number 2 and A Walk Through Hell number 8. So, Ronnie, I'll let you pick.
Let's go with Oberon number 2.
See, you read my mind, because that's the order I have him in. Oberon number 2, yes?
No, go ahead.
Okay. Oberon number 2, written by Ryan Parrott, with art by Milos Levkovich, letters by Charles Pritchett, covers by Milos as well. And let's talk about this. This issue reminded me of that movie The Labyrinth, with the wonderful and beautiful Jennifer Connelly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Partially because there is a actual labyrinth in this book.
Yes.
So maybe that's why. But it just gave me that feeling, and I really enjoyed it. I felt like maybe the jump between 1 and 2, to me it almost felt like we went back a little bit in time. Because Oberon didn't seem as devious in this issue as he did in the first one.
No, he didn't. But then you had, okay, what is her name? Is it
Bonnie?
No, not her, the mother. Is it Mother May I?
That's how, like, I read it, but I don't know.
Okay, that's how I read it too,
yeah.
To like put the spin on the whole game, mm-hmm, type thing. But I was just curious if that was just my backwoods hillbilly reading or not.
That reminds me, I got to show you this this video my wife sent me.
Oh.
It was what's the name? I think her name is Jay Lee. There's a female rapper. I don't know where she's from, but she talks about being from the Midwest. And when I first started watching it, she sent it to me. She's like, she's really good. And I started watching it, and I was like, is she joking with me, or is she for real?
This is like the Little Pump thing?
Yeah. So I'll remember me to send that to you. It was funny. She actually is pretty good. But some of the stuff she says, I'm like, is this for real, or is this a joke? Because it feels like an SNL skit.
All right.
Anyways, that's not what we're talking about. We're not here to talk about YouTube rap videos. So Oberon didn't seem as devious, because we started getting like this plan that he was hatching in the first issue, right? And this one you do get a little more in depth into, like, you know, there's something going on. But it just felt like the words he was choosing to use didn't overtly give that away.
Yes. Correct.
But, I mean, obviously he's doing something, right? Because he sends Bonnie to Mother May I to go to this labyrinth that apparently nobody has survived, which I don't think Bonnie even caught that. It was funny because – so Mother May I is like, yeah, this labyrinth was created by whatever, such and such guy, the trickster, for his kids, because whatever kid got through the labyrinth would inherit, like, his fortune and his magic and whatever else. But then she's like – but then when there were no heirs left, he gave the labyrinth to me to take care of. And I'm thinking to myself, like, yeah, obviously they all freaking died. And Bonnie doesn't even realize that, right? Like, she's just ready to go in the labyrinth. And then Mother Maya, like, overtly says something about, like, and you may die. She's like, wait, nobody told me that I might die in here.
Yeah. It kind of threw a wrinkle in Bonnie's character, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because the first issue, and even up until that point, and I guess after, she's always been sharp and witty, and, you know, she would have, I feel she would have noticed that.
Yeah.
So it kind of threw a wrinkle in how I perceived her after that.
Yeah, but at the same time, it almost made her seem a little more real, right? Because, I mean, if you're a kid and you get kidnapped to this magical fairy realm, the last thing you're thinking about is that some fairy king is trying to kill you.
Right.
Right? You're just like, hell yeah, like, I'm hanging out with the fairies. I'm going to do this cool labyrinth and maybe have magic powers. So that makes sense. But yeah, I agree. She, it did feel weird and a little out of character, but at the same time, maybe not necessarily out of character. Maybe it's exactly in character. I still want to know what happened with Oberon and Titania.
Mm-hmm.
So you do get the image of the wedding, the flashback of the wedding, mm-hmm. Between the two. But then when Oberon goes to see Mother May-I, you kind of get the feeling that Titania just kicked him out of the house.
Yeah. It was like a lame ending.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm curious what that story is, but it's cool. And you get to, you learn a little bit more about the world. I like the whole thing with the goblin. Somehow mm-hmm. Oberon's got like a sun under his cloak or whatever. mm-hmm. That was funny. I think that's the thing about this issue. The first issue seemed a lot more serious than this one. This one had a lot of comedy in it to me. Maybe it's just the way that I read it.
Yeah. I don't know if it was as heavy as the first one, but I still read it as there were stakes to be had.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like the frog, the headless frog.
Yeah.
You know? So, or not the headless frog, but yeah, you know.
The impaled frog.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which I assumed Oberon did that. Is that right?
Well, with the, because we still don't know who's narrating, right? We can only assume that it's Oberon. Since that's his color bubble.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, like, during that panel that he didn't know the travesty that was about to take place until way after. So,
well, see, so I remember reading that panel, and when you get to see what happens, I wondered if it's just like, Oberon's just kind of a fool. Like, maybe that's why Titania told him to get the hell out.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause he's kind of an idiot. And, like, maybe he comes up with these plans to be a villain or whatever, but just, like, messes them up along the way every single time.
Yeah. He wants to be a villain, but he's not very good at it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And so maybe his plan wasn't to kill that frog, but whatever he did to get there somehow caused that to happen.
Right. Like action reaction.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, I don't know. You're right. It was definitely much lighter reading than the first issue, but I really enjoyed it. It's a pretty fun book. The art's great, and I'm curious like what the ultimate plan is, right? And I want to know if we're gonna meet Titania. I'm assuming we are, because I don't think they would flash back to this wedding scene if she wasn't gonna be a part of it. And obviously, she keeps getting mentioned along the way with new characters we meet. So we'll see. But I'm very curious, and of course I want to know what the hell Bonnie's deal is.
Yeah,
because there's obviously a connection there.
Yep, I agree. Now, Oberon's assistant.
Yes,
that's like a play for like being an artist. What's the word? It's an art. What am I thinking of, Martin?
Like, I don't know.
Where he always, like, looks at himself in the mirror and...
Oh, narcissist?
Yeah, there you go. Mm. Right? Because, like, everybody else, except for Bonnie, even Bonnie is kind of not normal-ish looking, but, like, everybody else is, like, fantasy looking, right?
Yeah.
Except for him.
Mm.
So, like, is he an actual human that is his servant? Or is he, like, a shapeshifter that just takes that form for to make Bonnie feel more comfortable, like the sales pitch part of it?
So, if I remember right, in the first issue, he did say that he was a human.
Okay, because I couldn't remember.
And he made some kind of deal with Oberon. That's why he's kind of his servant.
Okay.
But But yeah, they do mention the thing about him being so beautiful, right? Like Mother mm-hmm. Mayat makes some kind of joke about it,
right?
When they're hanging out there. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, to me, he's kind of like the buffoon, right? The comedic relief.
Yeah.
You always had that in those old Shakespeare plays. There was always like the serious action, and then you would cut to like the sidekicks, right? Like usually a couple of soldiers or whatever, guards, that would just do stupid stuff and mess things up on purpose. Well, not on purpose. Just like they were so dumb that they would mess things up.
Right.
To kind of help advance the plot and do some exposition. I mean, I just think that maybe that's kind of his role here, with Titania and Oberon being characters from a Shakespeare play. I think it would make sense that Ryan would kind of bring those tropes in here as well.
Yep. I agree.
Cool. What else in this one?
That's about it for me. I like you said, I really like the different – I don't think we need them, but the different colored word bubbles.
Yeah.
For who's talking and whatnot.
Yeah, I think it definitely helps trying to figure out who's saying what.
Yeah, but I mean – some of the times, you know, it's pretty obvious who's saying what.
Yeah. Are you reading Fearscape?
Yeah.
They do that in Fearscape a little bit too, right? And I think that book is much more dense than this is.
Yeah.
So you definitely need that. And you know who the narrator is there.
Right.
But he's so unreliable that you kind of have to make that additional effort to make the reader understand who is actually narrating the story.
Right.
Yeah.
And it actually adds to the art on the page.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike the Jeff Lemire book where Descender,
uh-huh.
like where it was all different colors and some of the colors didn't work with the inks that were on the part of it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I enjoyed that book too, but, you know, this one actually, it seems like it pops with the actual art.
Yep, I agree. Never do red bubbles.
Yeah, or yellow.
Or yellow. Oh, yeah.
Yellow letters.
Ugh. Yeah. Whenever I see yellow on a page, I'm like, next page. I don't even look at it. I hate yellow. All right, let's rate it up. Ronnie?
I'm going 4 out of 5. I really enjoyed it.
I agree, Ronnie. I'm also going to go a 4 out of 5. And if Travis was here, he would also go a 4 out of 5. I'm putting words in his mouth. I have no idea. But that's my assumption.
So after this one, though, just real quick, do you still think it's YA-ish?
No.
Okay.
No.
No, I don't either. I think it's – I mean, it's a tweener book, I would say, that fits in the realm of that. Or, like, it could be, but it's also a lot deeper, I think, for old men like us.
Yeah, I think it's only YA in the straightforwardness of the writing.
Right, yeah.
Yep, I agree with that. All right, A Walk Through Hell, number 8. Garth Ennis writing, Goran Suzuka on art, Ives Scorsina on colors, and Rob Steen on letters. This one was also a very straightforward issue. Probably the very first straightforward issue of this entire series.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously there's a lot going on in here. There's a lot to dive into, but in terms of the structure and the narrative and who's doing what and what the hell is happening, I actually understood, we'll say 95% of this issue.
Yeah, I agree. And one of our friends that will be at C2E2 messaged me earlier today and said, hey, I just started A Walk Through Hell and I read issue 1 and 2 and they are some mentally challenging, messed up crap happening in this.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, yes. And until you get to 8, and maybe even 8 visually, you know, that's the whole damn series.
Yep, indeed. you gotta tell me later who it was. Basically, I mean, what we're getting here is Paul's origin story.
Yeah.
Told in his own weird way. And I think some of it seemed a little...
dramatized?
Yeah. I was going to say hyperbolized, but yeah, dramatized makes a little more sense, I think.
Yeah.
But also, like, he went through some really crappy shit.
Yeah.
His entire life.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, like, what it was that led him to the original murder, right? Killing his family. Because once he goes into juvie and whatever, into that home, there's a lot of, like, really bad stuff that happens to him.
Yeah,
right. And that I could understand giving him some kind of mental break where he goes on a killing spree. But before that, I mean, his family seemed, like, very proper and religious. So I don't know, like, what the break was. But, I mean, I guess that's part of what the book's about, right? When McGregor and I can't remember the other agent is talking to Paul.
Right.
And they're talking about, like, true evil and how evil is born. Maybe, like, that's just the way he is. He was just born an evil dude.
Well, and I think, like you said, though, like, him telling the story and us visually seeing the story is kind of two totally different things. You know what I'm saying? Because, like, he just basically snaps on his family in the picture.
Yeah.
But in the big, like, him telling it, he's justifying himself for doing it. Like, they're just a mundane family and, you know, they pray at supper, but they're just going through the motions type thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, later on when he's talking about being in the juvie and obviously he's getting, like, gang raped or whatever, he's, like, trying to convince himself almost, like, this is the plan the whole time was for me to get there. When, I mean, I don't know, you got to be really, really out there to want all the bad shit that happened to him in this book for the plan.
Yeah.
Like, what I'm saying is, like, everything that's happened to him, he's, like, trying to go back and connect dots that aren't there to make it seem to fit the plan that he's in right now, if that makes sense.
No, yeah, I 100% agree. And the thing is that on the surface, it definitely seems that way, though, right? Because, I mean, he kills his family, so he goes to this home, and all the kids pick on him. They beat him up. They gang rape him. They make him do drugs. And that just...
They make him eat out of the toilet.
They make him eat out of the toilet. And so those things, I think, compound whatever psychosis he has that led to the original break. And I think it's pretty normal for people to find connections that may or may not be there, right? I mean, you and I have talked about conspiracy theories because we love those kind of things. Not because we necessarily believe in them.
It's just fascinating.
Because it's cool, right? We're talking about that Paul Jenkins book that was coming out that was basically all about conspiracy theories and how this kid is making these connections. Like, that's what people do, right? We try to justify all of our existence in some way.
Yeah, and like a straw might be a link, like, for you and I, but to somebody else, it's like a covered bridge, you know?
Yeah.
How they see it's totally different. Because it fits their narrative.
Yes. Yeah. And this applies to a whole bunch of things. And I think that's something that we're getting a lot in this book. Because obviously Garth Ennis is a very opinionated person. He's got very strong beliefs about people in politics and all kinds of, and religion. And he's playing with those things concealed in certain imagery in this book. Some of it comes off maybe a little more pretentious than other things. And I know that there's things in this book that have come up that you didn't really like all the political stuff. But even in this issue, there's some political stuff, which to me made for the first time perfect sense with the story overall. Also in the way that those things were structured, it was pretty straightforward as well.
Yeah, I agree. And for the record, the first issue is the only issue that I've had. And that was just because we still don't understand the shock factor that happened in that first issue.
Right, right.
Like, why it's there.
Yeah, no, I got you. I got you.
But like you said, like, human views or people views is even demonstrated a lot in this issue, as well as the two agents sitting in the diner or at the bar and grill.
Mm-hmm.
And the guys try to buy them drinks or whatever and then get rejected. Right. Hardcore.
Right. Yeah, it's pretty interesting. But I mean, if you going back to Paul, if you look at all the stuff that's happened to him, you could see why he would be so confident in the fact that this is the way that it was meant to be for him.
Right. Yeah.
Because once you get maybe like halfway, he starts talking about how like you gotta make the right friends.
Right.
And there's obviously people that are helping him along the way. Some people that maybe agree with what he's doing, his methods. Like, for example, they talk about law enforcement, right? Like, why would this file be sealed? Like, it had to be somebody high up in law enforcement that sealed it.
Right.
And why would they want to seal it? What are they trying to conceal? And it reminded me of a show. Oh, man, I wish I remembered what it was called. I know there was one called The Cult, but that's not the one that I'm thinking of. That's Kevin Bacon. There was another one that came out that it was kind of similar to this. It was a guy that kind of – he was a serial killer, but I think he was like a psychologist or something, and this cult developed around him.
Yeah, it's the same one. That's The Following.
It's not The Cult. Yeah.
Yeah, because he was a professor.
That's right, a professor.
Yeah,
and
at a college.
Yeah, and he has a cult that develops around them because people like his ideology.
Right.
Right, and I mean, his ideology leads to him killing people, but they're okay with that. Because they believe in what he's doing. And that kind of seems the same way for Paul, right? Like, this mm-hmm. group has come around him that has maybe protected him for years, maybe developed some kind of cult around him, and that has helped justify some of this crap and given him the self-esteem he never had.
Right.
Right? Because now he's got people that follow his every word and do things for him to keep him safe.
Right. And kind of like what Garth Ennis like says in here is like he's ate shit for so long, now it's time to dish it out, whatever the justice is.
Yep. And what was weird is partially because of the storytelling, it's been hard to follow some things, right? But like the entire series, this guy has just really seemed like a really just evil dude.
Yeah.
But now seeing his backstory, he almost felt a little more human than he had before, right? He's not just the cold-blooded killer. I mean, he is. But now you understand kind of the reasoning why that is.
Right.
And for myself, as a person that likes to study how people work, it made a lot more sense to me. And as bad as it sounds, he didn't seem like such a bad guy.
I mean,
he's still a bad guy.
Yeah.
Because he's just killing people left and right. Yeah. But the fact that he was humanized a little more made it more interesting. Right, he wasn't some cartoon character serial killer.
Right.
There was a lot of depth behind that. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, Nick and I were just talking about this. We talked about the Joker for like an hour on the Nerdy Legion because I started talking. I started doing this psychology of Batman kind of thing, mm-hmm. And we kind of talked about this: the fact that like what makes the Joker a good character and when people write him correctly and write him incorrectly and our prefaces and things like that. But this kind of issue came up, right? Where this guy is, the immovable object to the agent's,
resistible force.
Yeah. Whatever it was.
Yeah.
Immovable object and unstoppable force. Yeah. Something like that.
Yeah.
Same kind of thing with this guy. And, it's pretty fascinating.
Yeah. I still don't think they humanized him a lot or, you know, as much as one could, I guess.
Sure.
But it still doesn't blur that moral line. Like, say, like what he's thinking he's doing is the right thing, obviously, instead of just a mustache twirling villain.
Mm-hmm.
But like, say, with Harada or whatever side of the Armada that you're in Animosity, mm-hmm. right? There isn't that moral blurred line here. Because, I guess there could be, because like you said, like The Following and whatnot. But like with Harada or whatever group in Animosity, you're like, what would you do in that situation type thing? Or what, you know, what makes it right morally and what makes it wrong morally. But here, we don't have all the pieces to that puzzle. We have from killing his parents, forward, but we don't have what happened before that.
Sure, but I don't know if that matters to me. I mean, I understand why you bring it up, but all right, let me throw out a weird idea to you.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
What if you the way you're looking at it is very objectively, right? Like there's a set group of morals that this society lives by, and this guy is counter to that, and so he's a bad guy. But you can, you know, you brought up animosity, for example. Depending on what side you're on,
yeah,
that truth may not necessarily be the truth, right? So like in animosity evolution, you have that group that's breeding girls to repopulate society, mm-hmm. right? Like obviously to that group, they've justified their belief that that's okay to do. And to them, they're right. And the people that are trying to stop them are wrong. Whereas if you're on the other side, I mean, these people are enslaving women in the basement to give birth to babies and do nothing else. And that's terrible. People right. should have the choice to do whatever.
Well, right.
I mean, that's very subjective. Maybe it's subjective here. Maybe he has somehow outgrown this sense of morality. That's why he feels maybe, I don't want to say entitled. That's probably the wrong word. But I'll use it anyway. It kind of entitled to do what he does and why he okay. feels like he's doing the right thing. Because he has maybe kind of grown beyond this objective morality thing. I don't know. It's yeah. a weird thing to talk about.
No, I get it. And it's a good point. I just, I would have to counter with like, the only difference is like animosity is like post-apocalyptic as to where here there's still like rules. Like human moral compass rules, right? Because in that way, anybody with like a PTSD would be free to do whatever the hell they wanted and feel justified for, right?
Sure. Yeah. Sure. But then, I mean, I can come back with you feel okay with it because animosity evolution is post-apocalyptic and you're not okay with it because this is still within society. Whereas what I'm telling you is that there's no difference.
Yeah.
And the barrier is really just a construct that society puts on people.
Yeah. No, I got it. I was just, you know, counter arguing.
Buddy, cause, I get it.
Cause I do like it. And I do like before this issue, he seemed like a one dimensional villain. Mm-hmm. And then this issue, now he feels like an actual quote unquote threat to our agents.
Yeah.
I mean, not to the, well, to the world or whatever, but like it gave more depth to his character.
Yep. So do you think Driscoll's in on it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I do. Do you?
I'm still undecided.
Okay.
I'm still undecided. I think there's some interesting things that are brought up as to how he's been able to do this for so long,
okay.
And escaping capture.
Uh-huh.
But I'm not necessarily convinced that Driscoll is in on it. I mean, she might be.
Okay.
But I think just by the simple fact that it was brought up, she's not in on it.
Okay. Like the red herring part of it?
Yep.
Okay.
And I think, I mean, you know, they assume that because she's in on it, that's why she's in the warehouse.
Right.
But my assumption is that she's in the warehouse because she's not part of it.
Ah, like a keep her quiet, shut up plan type thing?
Yeah, uh-huh.
Yep, that makes sense. Huh.
Yep, I mean, there's no reason for her to enter the warehouse if she's in on it, because if he's trying to show the agents what the world is about and what mm-hmm. he's about, mm-hmm. He doesn't need her help to get that accomplished, right? So her entering just puts herself in jeopardy.
Yeah, but what if she's... What if he's not the big bad, though?
And he might not be.
What if she's the big bad?
She could be. Maybe she went in there to silence him from telling the agents about her. That's very possible.
Because basically all he did here was basically take their blinders off and show them the bigger picture, whether they wanted to see it or not.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep, that's possible. But even then, I still think the case is he could handle himself perfectly fine in this place that he has created and doesn't need her. And if she wanted to quiet him, she could easily do that when he left the warehouse.
Yep, true.
So I don't think she's in on it. We'll see.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Yep.
Final thoughts?
No, I liked how this one was straightforward, but it was pretty deep all at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Past issue one, man, this has been off the rails in a roller coaster ride.
Yeah.
I mean, issue one was great too. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I'm on record not giving it a high score, but that was just because there was a lot of crazy stuff that wasn't getting connected for me.
Mm-hmm.
And there's still a big issue in that issue that hasn't been connected, unless it was just shock value.
Yep.
But yeah, I'm going to like 2 through 7. I gave 5 out of 5s. 8 gets a 5 out of 5 too.
I thought this was my favorite issue so far of the series. I feel like I say that every time we talk about the book.
Yeah.
But I really truly feel like this book gets better and better as you go on. And I mean, I'm going to give it like a 35 out of 5. because I don't think we have enough of this type of storytelling in comics anymore, right? Mm-hmm. If you look at comics from like 30 years ago, you would have a writer on a book for like 100, 200 issues, and they could develop this world. And we don't have that anymore in comics because people don't have the attention span to continue. Well, for one, the stories are really complicated, right? Each issue is very complicated.
Mm-hmm.
People just don't have the patience for that anymore. And the fact, I think, that Aftershock puts out a book like this, to me, says a lot about the quality of storytelling that Aftershock puts out. So, yeah, 35 out of 5.
Yeah, definitely.
Fantastic. All right. Next week, there are 2 books. I had it pulled up, and now I lost it. Where'd it go? Oh, there it is. Next week, we have Animosity number 19 and Dark Arc number 15. Man, it feels like we just got Dark Arc, like, last week.
Yeah, it was like a month ago.
Jesus Christ. all right.
I don't think he's showing up this issue, by the way.
Oh, yeah?
Well, you said Jesus Christ, and it's Dark Arc. Come on.
He might.
Come on!
Maybe he's in that pyramid.
Maybe. Might be.
Anyways, you can find us on Twitter at Rumba316, at Geekvine, at The Great Magnet, at Aftershock Pod. If you're going to be in Chicago, C2E2, we'll be there. What's that? In 2 weeks.
Yep.
March 21st to the 24th. So come say hi. I'm going to be wearing my, I don't know, I don't have a shirt for it yet.
I'm going to wear my Aftershock cease and desist shirt.
Are you really?
I don't know.
That's hilarious. Anyways, thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time.
Read dangerously.